It was another busy week in the world, and we'll break down some of the biggest local stories today during the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for joining me. Coming up in today's show, we'll take a look at Governor Scott Walker's departure from the presidential race. And joining me for the first time will be our art critic, Mary Louise Schumacher. She's got the latest on a design competition that could change how we access the lakefront here in Milwaukee. First, a major political donor to Scott Walker wants approval from the state to move a floating bog away from his property. Lee Berquist has the story.
There is a proposal before the Department of Natural Resources by a property owner who is a political supporter of Governor Walker, who wants to move a floating bog, an estimated 12 acres in size, from one portion of the of a bay in the Chippewa Flowage in northern Wisconsin to another part of the bay away from his property. And the problem that he sees is that this floating bog, which moves with the wind during the when there's not ice on the flowage, is that it's run up against his property, and he is not able to navigate his boats out onto the flowage, onto this big lake in northern Wisconsin, because this flowage, or pardon me, this floating bog is in the way.
What kind of environmental impact would it have if you were to move and perhaps secure the floating bog in a different area of the flowage?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. The Department of Natural Resources, as of Friday morning, is declining to comment on that question. It's still looking at this. There are people who I've talked to who live on the flowage, and also a representative of the local Chippewa tribe, the Lakuturé tribe, which has property on the flowage, who are concerned about the environmental aspects of this. Maybe they don't know exactly what the problem will be, but the idea of moving such a large mass mechanically and then fixing it to the ground, and we can talk about that in a moment, raises questions to them.
Yeah, how would they get the bog to remain in one's place?
Well, according to the documents I have, and so far that's the only thing I'm working with, in a memo from the property owner to the DNR, is that they would take large power boats and get behind one end of the floating bog and push it with large power boats across this bay. Now you are going to have this bog, which is a big tangle of ground and shrubs and even trees. Some of them could be 20 or 30 feet high, these trees. And these trees almost act like sails and can then push this bog around the water, because the trees capture the air and can move this bog around. Once it's on the other side of this bay, along public land, the proposal is to drive massive columns into the floating bog and into the lake bed, and these columns would be skewering this whole big bog, and so that it would be locked down in place and attached permanently to the lake bed, and that these columns, which are 4 feet in diameter, would stick up about 15 feet into the air when it's all done.
Since we don't know the environmental impact of this, do we know if there's an environmental impact study being done at the very least?
No, at this point there is no study like this. It's quite preliminary, and the reason why it's drawing my attention and drawing attention from some of the few property owners now who have heard about it is that it just seems to be appears to be unprecedented on the Chippewa Flowage in northern Wisconsin. This would all be done by the owner, and the owner of the property is a man named Richard Uihlein, who has been a contributor to Governor Walker. And in a story I wrote about last week on another property that he and his wife are involved in, using Journal Sentinel reporting from August, the E-Line and Mr. E-Line and his wife have contributed in the last couple of years to Governor Walker about $3 million to his presidential campaign and to his gubernatorial races in the last two elections. Mr. Uline has a legitimate concern that everyone has an access. If they have lake property, they should have access to the lake. If in these instances where there's a floating bog, people have been known to move small bogs away from bridges or from their property. This has happened before. This seems to be just such on a much grander scale, but I don't think one can ignore the fact that this is not just a supporter of Governor Walker, but an individual that is one of his largest political contributors, and it just has to be part of the reporting.
For more on Lee's work, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com. Ever find it hard to navigate getting to the lakefront? Well, you're not alone. The city of Milwaukee recently held a high-profile design competition that aimed to address that exact issue. Here's art critic Mary Louise Schumacher with more.
There's a section of the lakefront that has been for a long time considered kind of the cultural campus of the city. And up on the bluff and down on the lakefront, there's just a ton of stuff going on. So you have the NML Tower and Commons going up, which is like the size of a small city. It's like the largest office complex that's gone up in like 40 years. You have the proposed, actually now planned, Couture Tower, a 44-story apartment tower, the streetcar that will run through the base of it, massive roadway changes that are moving the I-794 spur kind of further south down towards the Hone. You have the War Memorial Complex being refurbished. The Art Museum has an expansion. I mean, there's just this whole area of the lakefront is going through this dramatic transformation. And one of the results of this is there's this little gap in the middle of all of it that is, you know, where there's nothing going on. And it's sort of in the middle of this area of the lakefront that doesn't make a lot of sense to people. So when you go down there, you see people having a hard time figuring out, like, how do I get from the bluff down to the art museum or over to Summerfest? And it's the pedestrian passageways are very kind of constrained and too few. And so there's this obvious need with more development for additional pedestrian passageways. And so they needed a bridge, but the bridge would have gone to this little area, this little gap where there was nothing. So, you know, what do you do in a situation like that? Well, you've got all of these kind of competing forces, private and public, kind of at play down there. And it was a really smart idea to come up with the idea of, let's get some great designers from across the country to figure out what to do with this space. So that's the competition, and that's what I'm covering this week. You know, the lakefront has for a long time been developed in a really piecemeal way, you know, with a focus on buildings and projects as opposed to the broader issue of a vision for the lakefront, and having public spaces in between that make sense and help people figure out where to go and give people places to be that are just destinations in their own right. And so this design competition was really set up to address those issues.
Why has it been that the lakefront has been developed and, you know, piecemeal bit by bit?
Well, you know, great cities are planned, and there's always this tension between having vision and courage and plans that have a certain element of strictness to them and having flexibility that allows for historic conditions. And we have had more of the latter and less of the former in Milwaukee. And so there have been a lot of really fantastic ideas for creating spaces between all of our cultural attractions that make more sense. But we just haven't focused enough on those things. We've been focusing on, oh, what's the art museum going to look like? You know, what's the new stage at Summerfest? And not on, how do I get from O'Donnell Park to the water's edge? How do I get from Juneau Park down to the War Memorial? You know, and those connections have been over time really lost.
If you're interested in reading that story, you can pick up Sunday's edition of the Journal Sentinel. It's also available online at tapmilwaukee.com. What's the latest with the Milwaukee Bucks' new arena? The Bucks owners are saying the facility may not open until a year later than originally planned. Here's business reporter Tom Dakin with the latest.
Well, first of all, the Bucks have said they want to get building it as soon as possible, but in reality, it's going to be months, possibly several months, I believe, because some big things still have to happen, even with the financing package now completely approved. The City Council, Common Council this week was the final step in that process. First of all, there has to be a lease negotiated between the Bucks and their future landlord, which will be the Wisconsin Center District. That's an agency created by the state to operate the convention center and other public venues downtown. And that lease is in some ways simple in the sense that the Bucks don't pay rent, but leases cover things other than rent, and there will be a lot of things that will need to be negotiated. There'll be a development agreement negotiated where the Bucks have to agree to actually build the arena. There'll be a non-relocation agreement negotiated in which the Bucks would face certain sanctions if they were to ever leave Milwaukee before the lease expires. All that's subject to negotiation, and that's the first step. Once you get those things done, you then have to sell the bonds with which the money is borrowed to do the public financing side of this project. That's going to be complicated. That will take a certain amount of time. In addition, the Bucks haven't yet submitted their final project plans for a plan review by the Plan Commission and Common Council, so that process needs to happen. So there are some major steps that need to occur before we can actually see construction begin on the arena and the other parts of this project.
Now, for the team itself, what does this mean for them or for the players in the coming years?
Well, I think in likelihood, what it's probably going to mean is that they're not going to be in their new arena until a year later than they originally planned. They have continued to say that they hope to be in it by the start of the 2017-2018 season, but given everything that still has to happen, they have acknowledged that it might be the 2018-2019 season, and I think that's realistically the more likely target. I mean, obviously, they want to get the arena built as quickly as possible because they'll make more money with the arena built. I mean, they'll have more seats in the lower bowl of the arena where they can charge more money, particularly club seats. But it's probably just going to take a year longer than they had hoped.
Okay. Now, you said that there are no fiscal repercussions for taxpayers. When it comes to the city's ability to plan or the city's ability to maneuver as this development is made, what kind of implications does that have?
Well, I think the only implication is going to be when the bonds are sold, how much the city and the Wisconsin Center District, how much those entities have to pay in interest rates. When you sell bonds, you're obviously selling bonds at any given time in the market, and interest rates fluctuate. And right now we're enjoying some historically low interest rates. Ideally, that continues into the period in which they sell the bonds. That would really be the only change I can think of off the top of my head that would really affect taxpayers. I mean, in essence, you have to borrow $250 million. And whether you do it today or you do it 6 months from now, you still have to borrow $250 million. So in that sense, that principal amount doesn't change.
Tom's story was featured in today's Journal Sentinel. You can also find it online at jsonline.com/business. As you probably know, Governor Scott Walker stepped out of the presidential race this week. Why? Well, that depends on who you ask. James Causey and Christian Snyder weighed in with editor Greg Borowski during this week's JS on Politics chat.
Let's talk about Scott Walker. It's been a couple of days now, and words get, you know, more details start to come out about why he left the campaign and why it was there and who's to blame. Let me start, Christian, with you. Who's at fault here? Is it Rick Wiley? Is it Scott Walker? You know, who didn't see this coming with the finances?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, you know, after the fact, like within hours suddenly of Walker getting out of the race, you know, the veil is lifted and we kind of see what we didn't know all along, all the troubles that they had up to that point. You know, Wiley's actually been in the media a lot, you know, saying, well, you know, it's kind of not my fault and Walker's to blame. And he didn't say that. But, you know, it's just interesting. It seemed like they both hatched this plan to ramp up and hire 90 people right off the bat. And somehow in the span of 70 days, they were able to rack up $700,000 in debt by hiring all these people. I mean, I know rappers that have better financial sense than that. And, you know, when he came out there and, you know, he started having all these missteps and he started having all these problems, rounding up voters and rounding up donors, that's when the whole model started to fall apart. And, you know, it's just interesting that it's only after the fact that we realized
all this. Well, I mean, given this, and I'll ask James, given the timing of his announcement and his departure, we haven't even seen the first campaign finance report, which we might have indicated what he was spending and how much, but clearly inside the campaign they knew what was coming in and what was going out. Do you think that was a fundamental flaw for them, James, to not, you know, right-size the campaign earlier?
Yeah, I think he had a go-for-broke approach. I mean, he invested a lot of money early on and got a lot of people on his team early on because he had a lot of momentum. And when he started having those missteps, it just all backfired and blew up in his face. And because of that, you know, we hear about all the money problems he had. I mean, it was a disaster. And it falls on Walker himself. I mean, it's the people who you surround yourself with who play a critical role in how everything shakes out.
All right, so we're not quite even 72 hours after the announcement, but the governor called for others to leave the campaign. Is anybody listening to that? Or does anyone else have a reason to leave, at least from the financials perspective, that the governor did? Christian, what do you think?
Yeah, he's not only his own campaign manager, now he's managing everybody else's campaign.
Well, he does need other things to do with that spare time now.
Yeah. I mean, as Stephen Colbert pointed out, you know, God told Walker to get into the race, and now he's telling him to lead by getting out of the race, which means God has a pretty bad super PAC, I think. The problem is these are all connected, the fundraising and the race itself. And, you know, as bad as he was as a candidate, he couldn't raise the money because he was a bad candidate, because he went into the race being the guy, you know, that was consistent. That was his thing. And as soon as he started flip-flopping on ethanol and started flip-flopping on immigration and things like that, he suddenly lost the entire reason that he had gotten the lead in the first place.
To find the full version of that chat, visit jsonline.com/politics. It's also available as a podcast on both iTunes and Stitcher Radio. No matter when the new arena arrives, the Bucks are ready to go. Here's Matt Velasquez and Charles Gardner with more.
The Milwaukee Bucks open training camp on Tuesday in Madison, and Charles F. Gardner will be there covering the team for the 13th straight year. What are some of the storylines coming into this year, Charles?
Well, Matt, probably the number one storyline will be Jabari Parker and his return. How much can he do in training camp? We talked to John Hammond and Jason Kidd yesterday at the Bucks golf outing, and they both said that he should be able to participate in camp, but how much he'll be doing will be something we'll be monitoring closely. But they're going to be very cautious with him, and how much he will do remains to be seen. But all the reports are good about Jabari. He's worked very hard this summer, and he's been at the training center on a daily basis. So I think the Bucks feel that he's going to be able to get some quality work in during training camp. But I thought the interesting quote from John Hammond where he said, if we think he can play 30 minutes, we're going to play him 15. So that tells you they're going to err on the side of caution with Jabari. He's just so valuable for them.
You know, and outside of Jabari Parker, are there any other players who look to be primed for important seasons or important roles with the Bucks this year?
You know, there's a lot of excitement about Greg Monroe. Also, Matt, because we're talking about one of the elite free agents who signed with the team in the offseason, signed a maximum contract. Everybody knows the story, how the New York Knicks and Los Angeles Lakers pursued him, but he chose the Bucks instead. Said he wanted to come somewhere that he thought he could win right away. He hadn't made the playoffs in his time in Detroit. He wants to play for a winning team. And, of course, the Bucks didn't have a low-post scoring presence last year at all. despite the improvement they made, that 26-game improvement they made, the center was not a position where they were going to get scoring. Now all of a sudden you've got a guy who's a very effective low post scorer. So how is that going to change their team? How is that going to change the look of the Bucks? They still have these athletic players around him, including Chris Middleton, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Jabari, when he's fully healthy. So I think the Greg Monroe story also is going to be very intriguing to watch. Also, of course, you can't forget Giannis. We know he's not going to play the first game of the regular season because of the suspension from the last playoff game when he decked Mike Dunleavy into the seats, as Bucks fans will recall. But Giannis has had a very good summer, played for Greece, and did very well. Greece did very well in the Eurobasket. So it'll be interesting to see what the next step for Giannis is now in his third season. So a lot of good storylines. Grievous Vasquez, new point guard, who's going to back up Michael Carter-Williams. Michael Carter-Williams hasn't had a full training camp. Remember when he came in at the trade deadline? That was a tough deal for him for a while before he finally got his footing. So now he's going to have a full training camp with the team. And that should be a big advantage for him.
You know, and the signings of Greg Monroe and Grievous Vasquez, those aren't the only ones the Bucks made during this offseason. They also extended the contract of general manager John Hammond. What kind of effect does that have on the team and the organization going forward?
Well, I think it's a real stabilizing effect, Matt. John Hammond now has 2 years left on his contract. That lines up with Jason Kidd, the head coach, having 2 years left on his contract. It shows the ownership is saying, hey, we want you guys to work together to build a winner here. And, of course, a lot of the thought when Jason Kidd came in was that John would not stick around, or there was a lot of speculation as to what his status would be. But the owners said when they came in, Mark Lasry, Wes Edens said, we're going to look at all facets of the organization. And they obviously liked what they saw with John Hammond. John has made some big moves that have helped the team, including the Chris Middleton trade and Brandon Knight. Then they spun that Brandon Knight trade off to get Michael Carter-Williams. So they've been rebuilding in a positive way, it seems. And Giannis Antetokounmpo, that was the 15th pick in the 2013 draft. And John Hammond gets some credit for that. The staff, the scouting staff as well, gets some credit for that, for finding Giannis and taking him with the 15th pick and him becoming such a good player. So I think it showed a lot of trust in John and for him to get that extra year. And I think it's a stabilizing force for the organization and as it moves forward and goes into this season.
Of course, if you're interested in more on the Bucks, you can visit jsonline.com/Bucks. And that wraps up today's show. Thanks so much for joining me. Know that you can find previous episodes and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Thanks for joining me. Have a great week, and you'll hear from me next Sunday.